A growing number of supplements are being marketed for pets, but how safe and effective are they? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We have our experts here today to discuss pet supplements, our pets' impact on the environment, and whether our cats and dogs should be sleeping with us. Plus, they'll answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are MedVet Cincinnati Medical Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, veterinarian and certified cat behavior consultant, Dr. Denise Johnson, and certified professional dog trainer and owner of Paws Look Listen, Nick Hoff. Welcome back, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They are ready to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Keep in mind, the advice given on our show is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit with your veterinarian. So I want to start by asking, what are you all noticing when it comes to these wellness industry ads targeting pet owners? I mean, do you feel like there's just been a proliferation of products and ads? Nick, are you seeing lots of stuff aimed at your dogs? And you have cats too.
Yes, I definitely do see quite a number of them. For me, I really pass right over most of the advertisements in general, but especially supplements or anything targeted towards my pets. If it is anything that is supplement related, I'm going to be reaching out to my vet and running by them what their thoughts are on them.
Yeah. What about you, Dr. Wells? Are you just seeing, does it seem like there's more and more stuff available out there?
Oh, absolutely. I think the pet industry is big business. And I think more and more people are realizing how committed owners are to their pets and what they're willing to invest in their pets. And so I think people are definitely jumping on that bandwagon. But similar to people, right? Even for us, there are so many things out there that may or may not be ideal for you. But if they market it appropriately, it seems great. And so I think we're definitely seeing that same thing in the pet space. And certain things, if it claims it's going to treat everything, it's probably going to treat nothing, right? There are some that are very helpful that are more specific, but.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about those, but let me ask you first, Dr. Johnson, are there any supplements you use for your own pets?
I do use supplements for my own pets. I have a couple cats that are high stress for various reasons. So I actually use VetraScience Composure for one of my little anxiety kids. And then I do have a couple of my cats on a probiotic from Purina Fortiflora. So those are ones that they have good research to back up their effect. And we implemented those with a very keen eye for, all right, is this actually moving the needle for us? Is this giving us significant benefit? And I think that's one of the things that we sometimes miss out on is not necessarily looking at our baseline, making a single change at a time, and really critically assessing whether something's helping or not. One of the big concerns that I have for a client, a caretaker who's using over-the-counter products is if we're not very, very mindful about how we're introducing that, we may be actually having a little bit of a placebo effect and hoping for the best and seeing the best when we're not necessarily having a real functional improvement for that pet.
Yeah, well, that's the tricky thing because the pets can't tell you, ooh, that makes me feel better, or, oh, that doesn't make me feel better. Dr. Wells, you mentioned that there are some that, you know, you feel better about than others. Are there, what are some of the ones that you feel comfortable either using or recommending to clients?
Yeah, so I don't know that this so much falls in the supplement category, but I consider it. So I look at fish oil. So I think even as humans, we should all probably be taking fish oil. And in dogs especially, it has been proven to be beneficial in a number of things, including inflammatory joint disease, certainly certain cardiac conditions, those sorts of things. So I think fish oil is something that can be really beneficial in a number of ways. Some of the glucosamine products, although even the literature on that is pretty indeterminate as to whether it is actually helping these patients. It seems like long-term, early on, that can be beneficial. So I would say those. She mentioned probiotics can be beneficial, certainly in some disease conditions. I think the big thing is just like in humans, they talk about vitamins. Vitamins aren't regulated by the FDA. Neither are any of these supplements. So ideally, really going with companies that have done research, are willing to put that out there. I think your veterinarian is a great resource, especially there are a number of veterinarians that do focus on integrative medicine and using some of these more supplemental treatments that have a good education on that and can be really great wealths of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Instead of just listening to the Facebook ad and going for it.
Yeah, because they're expensive too. That's mm-hmm. the other thing is some of these are not inexpensive products. And even some of the veterinary ones that do work well, you don't always need them for your pet. And so I've had some clients that are on supplements that I might be recommending this, that, or the other. And they say, well, I don't have any money. And some of the $150, $200 a month they're sending on a supplement could be used in a different way that might be more beneficial for your pet.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh, I didn't realize some were that expensive. Nick, are there, after talking with your vet, are there any that you've used for your dogs? I know you have some big dogs.
Yeah, I've used a variety of supplements over the years with my big guys. I have, per my vet's recommendation, looked at glucosamine, chondroitin types of supplements with my dog for his behavioral issues. I also utilized Anxetane, which is an L-theanine supplement that has reviews that are helping to support that it is effective at reducing fear, anxiety, and those types of things, which I always encourage my clients to talk with their vets about if they're looking at any types of supplements.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting because I hear so many people just, there are all these CBD supplements that are supposed to, over-the-counter, that are supposed to help with things like anxiety. Do you find any of those, have you ever found those to be effective, Dr. Wells?
I think CBD can be effective. I'm not sure it's as effective for as many things as they claim it to be, but I do think there are probably scenarios in which it can be beneficial and helpful. I will say, admittedly, that's something that with at least myself and maybe Dr. Johnson has a different opinion. That is something I'm not as comfortable with in talking to clients about, and is something I probably need to do better on because it, for so long it wasn't legal. And so we didn't really venture down that path. So I do think there are benefits to it, but probably not quite as many as have been stated to this point.
Yeah. Dr. Johnson, do you get a lot of questions about that?
Oh, heck yeah. I want to be kind of skeptically optimistic about CBD as an option kind of moving forward as we do gather more data, since it has been pretty restricted in terms of the research potential so far. There is good evidence for osteoarthritis support. There's kind of mixed evidence as far as I've seen so far for anxiety. There was a study, apologies, I don't have the author's name, but they looked at whether CBD could be helpful in noise-phobic dogs, and they compared it to trazodone, which is a prescription medication that has been used fairly effectively. And the dogs that were given the CBD performed worse than the dogs that were given the trazodone. Mm. And the dogs that were given the combination of those two, someone definitely correct me if I've misinterpreted, but I believe that they performed worse with the combination than with the trazodone alone.
Oh, wow.
So that at least is enough to give me pause. And when somebody voices to me that they are interested in trying that or they have already been trying it at home for their pet, I just try to be really frank in that our data is limited. Behavior is a study of one. We see drastic differences in individual patients in their response to given medications. So there may be a pet who responds beautifully to CBD, and that is a better answer for them than our more traditional protocols. But there is more potential for interaction risk because we don't have as much concurrent use information. And there's a lot that we don't know. So again, really being aggressive about setting the criteria of what are we trying to change besides just less anxious, because that's a pretty nebulous kind of category. Mm-hmm. But looking really specifically of what anxiety behaviors specifically are we trying to address? How many or how frequently are we seeing those, or how severe are they pre-treatment versus post? And how do we feel about that? So really just thinking critically, and I'm not averse to, you know, giving something new a try, but I'm also, at this point in the stages of research, I'm not making that as a recommendation. I'm just having that discussion if somebody brings that to me.
Okay. We do have a caller on the line. Hey, Tim, thanks so much for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Yeah, so my wife and I, we've had quite a few rescue dogs through the years, and we do our very best to give them the same kind of medical attention as any other family member. And I won't name any names, of course, but we've been to a number of vets in this area that when we've had surgeries on our dogs, you know, they've tried to promote and push things like red light therapy, which I have a science background. I know how to read and write and, you know, evaluate journals and scientific evidence. And while there's some evidence for red light therapy helping with pain, actual healing, there's not so much good evidence for. And the way that the red light therapy was promoted by the vets and the vendors of the red light therapy, whose literature was given to us by the vets, they did say things that were not well backed by science, such as that they would promote healing and you know, draw healing cells to the area where there is surgery, which is, you know, not well supported, if close to actually being not true in the science. So, and I get that there's no harm in red light therapy, but there's harm to a budget. And if you only have so much money to spend on your pet's medical needs, you need to be able to make an accurate and true decision on what you're going to spend that money on.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. I'm sorry I'm going to stop you there because I want to let Dr. Wells weigh in first. What about these things like red light therapy? Are you familiar with that? Is that something that you all use or talk about at MedVet with patients?
I have to admit that red light therapy isn't something I have a lot of experience with. We don't do red light therapy specifically. We do laser therapy and shockwave, which does have a lot of research and science behind it. But red light is not something that I'm as familiar with.
Hmm. What about you, Dr. Johnson? Is that something you've ever used with any of your patients?
Similar to Dr. Wells, I have familiarity with some laser treatments, but not red light therapy specifically. I would just say, anytime we're looking at a treatment plan where there may be some degree of either, you know, real world budget limitations, I think it's really important that practitioners and caretakers have a really frank conversation about, all right, here are our treatment options. Here is our ranking of importance, the, you know, what is going to be most critical to quality of life, success of treatment, and looking at if we do need to pare something down, what realistically can be chopped without that having a significant impact on outcome.
Yeah.
I think that's an important conversation to have.
Yeah, I know I always appreciate those frank conversations with my vets. Well, thanks so much, Tim. That was a really interesting call. Really appreciate your calling in with that. We have another caller on the line. Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
So what is your question?
I have a naughty kitty cat.
No.
She lost, yes, very. She lost her brother in about a year ago, and then in May, she lost her sister.
Aww.
And now she's been doing some inappropriate urination outside of her box. We adopted another cat in May, because we didn't want her to get weirder than she already was. But now, you know, there are three litter boxes. They're always cleaned, but she keeps urinating, defecating. It's in the same spot. She will go potty literally right in front of the litter box.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's stress or grief or just having a fit because she doesn't like her new brother or I need help.
Yeah, well, thanks, Rebecca. Dr. Johnson, as a cat behavior consultant, I'm going to ask you about that. I do feel bad for this little cat who lost her siblings. Do you have any thoughts for Rebecca?
I do. House soiling is calling it a favorite thing is probably poor wording because I don't enjoy that they're doing it, but it's one of my favorite things to help with. I do think that it's really important to recognize that when we're looking at types of soiling, fecal house soiling, defecating outside of the litter box, is almost always related to some kind of an underlying medical concern or discomfort. That can absolutely be aggravated by stress, grief, other household happenings. But most commonly, there is some form of discomfort that cat has kind of blamed on or attributed to the box. Especially with it being so close to the litter box, I would worry that, you know, she's attempting to go in a socially acceptable area, but something has happened comfort-wise that has just made that box a dangerous place to defecate. So really looking critically at potential orthopedic discomfort, we can have issues where it's not necessarily the act of defecation itself that is the discomfort, but if it hurts to posture in that box,
climbing in and
out of that box. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Things like we can actually have dermatologic conditions, so issues with the paw pads. If they have uncomfortable toes, stepping into that litter can be a problem for them. We can even have unrelated abdominal conditions. So if we have something, and I'm hoping, and I would not want to say that this is happening to the subject kitty, but I have had cases where they've had a tumor in their belly, and when they have to put pressure, increase pressure in the abdomen in order to eliminate, that was uncomfortable, putting pressure on that tumor. So that was causing a little bit of an aversion. So I would strongly recommend in this instance to talk at length with your veterinarian about options for further workup, doing some blood work, a urine test, fecal testing, potentially some abdominal imaging to take a peek if there is something going on in there. And there's certainly room to bring in a behavior professional too to try and reduce stress in the home related to new brother, but really emphasizing that everything medical needs to be supported.
Hmm. Did you want to add anything, Nick?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I actually had a case last year where my cat began no longer going to the restroom in his litter box. And as a behavior professional, my first instinct with cats no longer using their litter box is always to check with the vet. We did that. And unfortunately, we found out that there was a tumor that he was dealing with. We weren't given a long time with him prognostically, but we actually got to enjoy him for another 6+ months, which was really wonderful. Aww. But I found that information out first and foremost because I saw this change in behavior. And before I tried to do anything else, I checked with my vet.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rebecca, I hope that helps. I hope there's nothing awful going on with your kitty, but I hope that advice helps. Thanks so much for calling and good luck with that cat. And now we have Ginger on the line. Hey, Ginger, what's your question?
Hi, I was so excited today when I heard the pet show was going to be on. I had to tell myself to calm down because you always get such great advice from the pet experts.
Well, thank you. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I have a couple of some questions about calico cats being female. Usually when I've had calico cats, they have been females. And I heard a couple of months ago on TV that there was going to be some research on why so many calico cats are female, or that there had been just recently some research on calico cats. And then my second thing about calicos was, my vet said to me one time about my calicos that, well, they're not as bold or opinionated or sassy as most calicos. And I said, well, I found them to be sweet, affectionate, and very, very attached to you. And my last question is that I did one time have a male calico cat, and my veterinarian said that he was sterile and that he didn't need to be neutered. Huh. So I just wondered if male calicos tend to be sterile, and I just thought it would be fun to talk about calico kitties.
Well, thanks, Ginger. I have a calico myself. Her name's Penny Turkey, and I hope she's not listening when we talk about sleeping in the bed because she loves doing that. Denise, do you have thoughts about calicos? Have you read any research about calicos?
We do have a good answer for why calico cats are primarily female. It actually has to do with the distribution of the color genes and relation to the X chromosome. So to get that fun patchy color distribution, you need to have that black and that orange, and you need to have that through the alternating of which X chromosome is activated in that given area of the skin of the coat. So in order for a male cat to have a set of two X chromosomes and also be phenotypically male or appear male, they most likely have XXY, and that is not very compatible with being able to procreate. I would still probably recommend neutering if there are testicles present, just because I'm not a big fan of how that testosterone makes kitties smell, but breeding would definitely be a little bit of a lower concern. I'm not sure if Dr. Wells has other opinions on that aspect.
I agree with you. I would say neuter them for, you know, the other reasons too. I think their urine is so much more odoriferous and those sorts of things. She mentioned, oh, this is a sweet calico. I don't know if this is just you know, our vet perception, but calicos are generally spicier cats. maybe it's just because they're female. I don't know. But we generally in the veterinary world do regard calicos as a bit spicier, just like at least Dr. Johnson, you can tell me if you agree, but orange males, we typically associate with being like the mellow, chill guys.
That's why I have two of them.
Yeah, see, the orange male is like the preferred kitty among veterinarians. But yes, those calicos tend to be spicy.
If you think that a calico kitty is spicy, an all-orange female.
Whew. A little chili pepper there, huh? Okay. Well, we've got lots more fun stuff to talk about. Ginger, thank you so much for those questions. I love talking about calico cats. We are going to keep talking about pets, and we'll be back after a short break. If you've got questions, now's a good time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about pets today for the full hour. My guests are veterinarian and certified cat behavior consultant, Dr. Denise Johnson, certified professional dog trainer and owner of Paws Look Listen, Nick Hoff, and MedVet Cincinnati medical director, Dr. Jennifer Wells. They're ready to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And another reminder, the advice you hear on our show is general in nature. It should not substitute for a visit with your veterinarian. We've got lots to talk about, but I do want to ask you about this trend, this raw meat diet trend that I'm seeing for both dogs and cats. Nick, is this ever something you've tried with your dogs?
Yeah, it is something that I've tried on occasion with mine before. At the time, I was most inclined towards it. Thankfully, it was cost prohibitive for me. I think it was going to cost me around $400 a week to feed my
$400 a week?
To feed my four St. Bernards, a raw meat diet. Yes, it would have been that expensive, at least to me at the time. It's also something that I do see around our conferences and such a lot. But I, once again, always lean towards my veterinarians and talk with them about what their thoughts are. But I do supplement on occasion with some raw meat diet options.
Yeah. What about that, Dr. Wells? Are there any safety concerns? Are there any risks associated with a raw meat diet for dogs or cats?
Mm-hmm. I mean, similar to us, right? We don't eat raw meat for a reason.
Yeah.
Salmonella, E. coli, all of those things affect our pets too. And so I am not against home cooked diet, those sorts of things, but our general recommendation is to cook it for that bacterial infection. And not to mention, in studies looking at people, it's a risk to you too. So if you have all this raw meat that you're handling, it's on your counters, it's in the dog bowls, it's a risk to you as well. So it's not just to your pet. So veterinary world is generally anti-raw diet. Again, that doesn't mean we're anti-raw home cooked, because I do know a lot of people over the years have become less trusting of pet foods and those sorts of things. So if you want to home cook for your pet, not a problem. Obviously, let's get it seen by a nutritionist. Let's make sure it's balanced, because people also have the assumption that a raw, it's just going to be balanced, and that's false. So whatever you're doing, it needs to be balanced, and we need a vet and ideally a nutritionist involved.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Helen. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
I'm calling about my cat. She's a short-haired cat, but she has a matted wad of hair on her back over her spine that I can't get out with just brushing. I wonder, is there an ointment I could apply? I'm afraid to cut it because I'm afraid I'll cut her skin.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Helen. What do you think, Dr. Johnson?
That really needs to be handled at a veterinary office. I do think that she's correct. You don't want to try and cut that out at home, because you could very well lacerate her skin. There's not an ointment that could be applied, and you can actually make matting worse by getting the hair wet. That has a tendency to kind of felt it down and tighten it, similar to if you wash your wool sweater, it might shrink on you. So at that point, if she's not able to just simply brush that out, then having a veterinary visit, potentially sedating to have that shave down, or if she really just needs a vet team to shave it without sedation, that may be an option too. But definitely would also talk about how that developed in the first place. Is this cat having difficulty grooming themselves? Are they not accepting grooming at home? And looking to see what could be done to prevent that from reoccurring in the future.
Yeah. I hope that helps, Helen. Good luck with your cat and her matting. I want to talk now to what I think is going to be a very controversial question, and that is sleeping with our pets. So I know I do this. I don't know how I could even keep my Penny Turkey out of the bed, because that is like her territory. She's claimed it. Nick, you have big dogs. So do you let your pets sleep with you? Very personal question, but want to know.
Yes, I do allow my dogs and my cats to sleep with me if they choose to. My dog, he will sleep in my bed, I'd say, once or twice a month. It's pretty infrequent for him. I have a lot of clients, though, that navigate this on a regular basis, and so I'm quite versed in all of the sleeping habits.
What about you, Dr. Wells?
Yeah, so I've lived on both sides of this coin, and my previous dogs did, but then I will say the quality of my sleep is negatively impacted by my pets, such that at this point, there's a baby gate at my door. And so, well, you can tell who my favorite is in the house. There's a baby gate that has a little cat door that opens. So the dogs cannot come in, but the cat can, though he also keeps me awake at night. So I think some people who sleep well and have no problems, I think it's fine, assuming. And I think a lot of people worry, like, oh, they're going to give us fleas, this, that, and the other. As long as you have your pet on good prevention, so heartworm prevention, flea prevention. Heartworm also covers most intestinal parasites. So at that point, I think your risk, other than just poor sleep because they lick or chew or cough or scratch, for me, that's what gets me the most.
Yeah. What about you, Dr. Johnson?
I do allow cats in the bed, but I also make sure that they have a potentially more appealing option, because when you don't necessarily want your cat to do a certain behavior, you can often win by giving them a, quote, better idea that is all their own. So we are very lucky to have a four-post bed with a rail at the top, so I made a hammock up at the top so that they can be in relatively close proximity, have that social value of being in the bedroom above the bed, but they get that fun bonus of I am high above everything and no children can, you know, murder me. And that can be very helpful. I think having an alternative that still, again, gives them some of that social contact, social support, but doesn't mean paws on your face, somebody kicking you. Obviously, a hammock for a dog is not going to be necessarily the solution, but think critically about what alternatives you can provide to them.
Interesting. Nick, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was going to say that for a variety of reasons, I think that looking at whether we give our pets furniture privileges, whether we're talking about the bed or the couch, for me, it's always going to be based first in, is this a problem to you? If you don't mind, then I don't see an issue. And are there any behavioral concerns surrounding this behavior? So I have had a multitude of clients where I've had to work with them on navigating a dog who would resource guard their bed, either from the owners more infrequently or potentially a partner. But I've had to navigate a couple of bites to children because of dogs being in the bed and that being an issue. So if we do have any behavioral concerns surrounding our dogs being in these more privileged spaces, we do want to make sure that we are managing that and addressing that moving forward. I'm also a huge fan, as the other doctor was saying, of providing an alternative space that is desirable for our dogs. So if we are trying to keep our dogs off the bed or off of the couch, providing a soft bed nearby for them to have and a good access point for that is going to help immensely with that behavior.
Okay. Well, we have another caller on the line. Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
My question is, we have a couple of adopted cats. I was trying to send a picture along, but I didn't get a chance. I know you close pretty quickly. The show closes. So it started with a little sore on his tail, and we've been to the vet. I'm not happy with what's going on. It continues to spread. They've given him a shot, and they've given him all kinds of cream to put on there. The fur is not growing back, but it looks like it's spreading up the tail on the top portion and on the bottom as well. It's kind of dry. It's not oozing anymore, but I'm wondering what that is.
Wow, that's an interesting question. I'll start with you, Dr. Wells. Do you have any thoughts about this? It sounds like a skin problem or something that one of Michael's cats has had.
Yeah, if it's primarily, it sounds like at one point it was truly a wound, in which case, you know, bacterial infection, abscess, those sorts of things. But with it spreading and just being dry, that could sometimes be a dermatologic issue, or it could be an endocrine issue. So it is a little bit hard to say without seeing it. But it also does take time. So let's say this was a wound and that wound has since healed. It will take a long time for that hair to come back. So if it just needs time, that could be it. But if it's truly spreading, it may be more than just a derm issue. It may be more of an endocrine issue as well.
Dr. Johnson, can there be over-grooming that could be going on?
There certainly can be over-grooming secondary to itching or discomfort. I have not personally seen a case of what's fancily called psychogenic alopecia, where it's just due to a behaviorally driven issue. Usually there is some other either derm, so skin issue, or orthopedic issue underlying. If they are excessively grooming, there can even be cancerous changes to the skin that cause over-grooming. In this case, I would really wonder how much testing was done and whether maybe we need to look and see if there is a resistant infection that wasn't responding to the initial treatment, or if potentially there's something fungal like ringworm that could be just blossoming and not being directly targeted by what's been given so far. But I would definitely, if you're not necessarily comfortable with the care you've received so far, there's nothing wrong with seeking a second opinion or potentially referral to a dermatologist. I'm not sure about what the availability is in you guys' area, since I'm calling in from Columbus. But I would definitely consider that if maybe you're not super satisfied with care so far.
Yeah. And Michael mentioned to our producer, one of the cats also has an ear infection. Can those be hard to treat or get rid of in cats, Dr. Johnson?
Those can be a massive pain in the butt, especially if they are deeper within the ear. So really important to get a very thorough exam looking at that eardrum to see if there's potentially any fluid behind it. And sometimes we even have to do advanced imaging, which I'm sure Dr. Wells would have more fun information about in order to screen and see if there's something affecting the middle or inner ear.
Yeah. Well, good luck with those cats, Michael. I hope they start to feel better. We have a couple of emails. We got an email from Katie who writes, we have two cats and are thinking of getting a dog. Our second kitty, 1 year old, was adopted last Christmas, and she and our tuxedo, 5 years old, generally get along except for getting into each other's faces occasionally. The tuxedo is very solitary and tolerates our newish kitty, but we're afraid introducing a dog might push the tuxedo to the brink. Any advice? I'm going to start with you, Nick. Do you have a lot of experience helping dogs get introduced to cats in a situation like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of both personal experience within my own households as well as working with a lot of my clients to help them with that. There's definitely a variety of things that we can do to help ease that transition, which we always want it to be a transition. So I am usually going to be looking at it, taking some time, being patient, and utilizing both some management techniques of using baby gates with cat doors, leashes, things along those lines so that we can help to manage the access to each other initially. I'm also, in general, a huge fan of having cat trees or other high spaces so that our cats can get up and away quickly as opposed to having to flee out of the room, which can elicit chase, which can exacerbate all of these issues. If we are dealing with any real high interest from the dog towards the cats or vice versa, working with a trainer can be helpful in navigating some of those things, but a simple initial exercise of providing some treats to redirect our dog away from the cats and using high-value treats can really help to incentivize them to refocus on their owners and to make good associations with the presence of their new furry friends.
Okay. We will be back to wrap up our pet show after a short break. If you've got questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back for the last leg of our pet show. My guests are certified professional dog trainer and owner of Paws Look Listen, Nick Hoff, MedVet Cincinnati Medical Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, and veterinarian and certified cat behavior consultant, Dr. Denise Johnson. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And remember, the advice you hear on our show is general in nature. It should not substitute for a visit with a veterinarian. We did get an email from Jim. Jim asks, is it okay to feed cats sardines? What do you think, Dr. Wells?
I think a little sardine treat here and there, not its primary diet, but a little sardine treat is not the end of the world. The only thing I'll call out is if by chance your kitty has underlying heart disease, I would not recommend that just because of the high salt content. But in a normal, healthy cat, I'm not opposed to a little sardine here and there.
You know, we were talking about a raw diet earlier, and I know that my vet cautioned me against feeding. I'm seeing a lot of freeze-dried raw cat treats these days, and she said you need to be worried about avian flu being a part of that. Is that something that you've been talking with clients about, Dr. Johnson?
I have not made that specific call out. I don't know the real prevalence or the severity of that potential risk. I do think that anybody who wants to feed raw anything needs to consider the basic hygiene concerns and the fact that not only are the food bowls and the faces of your cute little fluffy friend potentially a contamination source after feeding, but also anything that makes it through the other end. Their digestive tract is often cited as, oh, it's better equipped to handle such things than ours. Yeah, well, some of those things do make it all the way through, and that can represent more of a hazard around your litter box maintenance and sharing your bed and things like that. So I would just recommend exercising abundance of caution no matter what raw you're introducing, whether that's a freeze-dried or a different commercial preparation, and maybe just don't don't do it.
Well, that makes sense to me. Well, we were talking about things to feed pets. I want to talk about what we shouldn't feed pets, a little bit more about that, because big holiday gatherings are right around the corner. It can be so tempting to give our pets table scraps. Dr. Wells, what are some of the foods we should never feed our pets?
I think anything that is really high in fat. So, you know, the fat off the steak, or I have a lot of clients that like to get, we're in Cincinnati, and so like, I give pills in Braunschweiger. I'm like, oof, that's really high fat. But also, certainly grapes, raisins are toxic to pets. Chocolate, which most people know about, you generally do actually have to get a decent amount of chocolate for it to be toxic. But grapes, raisins, onions are a big no-no. Garlic, those sorts of things. So generally, if that is something that you want to do, I would think of things that are very bland and low fat. So if you give your pet a little bit of turkey off the turkey, it's probably not the end of the world unless they have food allergies, that sort of thing. But keep it very simple, very bland, I think are very safe things. Veggies, a lot of other fruits are typically okay.
Yeah. What about bones, Nick? Are there some bones that are okay and some bones that are off limits?
Those are going to be good questions back for the vet. But on the topic of giving table scraps and food from the table, I wanted to just touch on how the context of how we give food is more important than the food itself in terms of the behavior. Because I have some clients who are concerned about giving their dogs any type of human food. And I will often say that they won't necessarily know the difference between human food and not human food. But the context that we give any treats or food can make a difference. So if you give any food from the table, even at the end of the meal, you would be reinforcing any type of begging behavior, expecting that food could come from that. And so if you'd like to set aside safe foods that the vets are good with from your table, what I would suggest is set that food aside for a short period after the meal and then take it away from the table and then give it to your dog outside of the context of the meal so that we aren't encouraging that type of behavior. With my own dog, this is sort of happened in an interesting way where he knows that if I'm eating food at my table, he doesn't even bother to approach. However, if I'm standing and I'm eating a snack, he will often come over and politely sit to see if he can share with me, and I usually do. So he gets to get a goodie if I am standing and eating, but he understands that if I am sitting at the table that he needs to leave me alone.
Well, that's nice. We kind of trained each other.
Bones, generally no. Our dentist would tell you the dangers of their teeth and bones. I've also, as an internist, scoped ham bones out of an esophagus. It just gets stuck right there. So bones are not an ideal treat. Antlers, those sorts of things. They're really, really tough on the teeth. And a dentist would generally say, if it's safe, you should be able to bend it. So if it's safe enough for their teeth, it should be bendable.
Okay. Well, we got an email from Sue who says, I have a very anxious dog. Nick mentioned he gives one of his dogs a supplement that seems to help. Could he say the name of that supplement again?
Yeah, that supplement that I've used before is Anxitane, which is A-N-X-I-T-A-N-E. And that is an L-theanine-based supplement that I have had veterinarians and veterinary behaviorists recommend to me for my clients and for my own dogs before. But again, those are always going to be good things to run by the vet, even if just to make sure that they aren't going to see any bad interactions on their part.
And I think Dr. Johnson earlier had mentioned Composure, which is a good product as well. She might be able to speak
Love
better
to Composure.
That. Yeah.
Composure, Fortiflora, as she also mentioned. And then the other kind of nutraceutical over-the-counter option that some of my clients have explored before is Zilkine, which is a milk protein supplement. That and Anxitane are the two that I would suggest my clients speak with their vets about, though that is where they thrive.
Dr. Johnson, what about those plug-in dealies that you see all over the place that have, I don't know if they talk about pheromones or some kind of something that they're getting into the air to calm cats? Do those work?
They can. They're a relatively low-level intervention, so I usually don't recommend them as the only support measure. So usually I'll try and pair that with either an oral supplement or in all cases, some degree of behavior modification is indicated, so actually training and helping change that underlying emotional state. But the nice thing is now that Feel Away, which is kind of the OG pheromone diffuser. Now that that has been out for so long, there are alternative options that use that same classic pheromone. Basically, it's a synthetic version of what cats deposit on things when they bunt, when they rub their cheeks. So it can send a little bit of a calming, safe territorial signal. There are plug-in diffusers. I have really been liking, there's an alternative called Zenefel, Z-E-N-I-F-E-L. The benefit of it is that it is available in a gel diffuser, so you don't have to take up an outlet, which is a lot easier for very many places because you can't block the outlets with furniture and things like that. So then you're very beholden to your house layout. So the gel diffusers, they last for 60 days generally and just have more flexibility for placement. The big benefit to the plug-in diffusers is they do have different versions. So I mentioned the classic is that cheek pheromone. There is also a version that replicates what mother cats emit when they're nursing. So it's a different kind of calming signal. And some cats respond better to one or another. There's also Optimum, which is a version that combines both. So there's classic, multi-cat, or feel away friends, if you're in the UK. And the Optimum is the blend. So those are all available from FeelAway as a plug-in diffuser. The Zenefel, the gel diffuser, that's just basically analogous to the classic. Okay. So I would consider what works best for your home and give it a try.
Quick question for you, Nick. We got an email from Christine who says, when I get up from my bed in the morning, my dog likes to roll around where I was just sleeping. Why does she do that?
That is probably some scent rolling behavior. It is usually a nice sign. It's probably your dog loving your smell and wanting to kind of just coat themselves in it as well.
Aw, that's so sweet.
That is sweet.
It's really sweet.
My dog never does that. I don't know what that means.
Maybe it's because you kicked your dog out of the bed.
That's a good point. It doesn't go to the couch where that's I was right. sitting, though. He's yeah. not interested.
Well, Christine, you have a good puppy. That's such a sweet thing. Well, this has been such a fun pet show. I have been talking with MedVet Cincinnati Medical Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, veterinarian and certified cat behavior consultant, Dr. Denise Johnson, and certified professional dog trainer and owner of Paws Look Listen, Nick Hoff. Thank you all so much for your time today. We sure appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lucy May.